Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, October 3rd. I'm Ray Graff. We welcome back two astronomers to the studio today. Vox Pop mainstay Bob Berman is joined by Valerie Rapson of the Dudley Observatory at MySci in Schenectady. If you have an astronomy question, maybe gravity, meteors, Saturn's rings, this galactic group, I'll tell you what, you give us a call. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We'll run down some stirring space headlines coming up. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, and your astronomy questions coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers in the studio today to answer your questions about the final frontier. You know Bob Berman. He is the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. And you know Dr. Valerie Rapson, chief astronomer at the Dudley Observatory at MySci in Schenectady, New York. And if you have a question about the heavens, now is the time to call. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Tweet us if you want, at WAMC Vox Pop, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But that number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Great to be back.
Thank you.
All right, so I thought I would pull some space headlines from around the popular news media and have you comment on it. This is the first one. This is from The Express of London. Asteroid alert. NASA tracks huge near-Earth object approaching Earth at 38,000 miles an hour. It's twice the size of a double-decker London bus. Should I be terrified?
Short answer, no. You'll be just fine.
Okay, why?
Well, you know, anytime I see these like asteroid alerts, everybody get nervous headlines.
Yeah.
I always like have to dig in and say, okay, how big is the object and how close is it going to get? Because, you know, they act as if it's about to hover over our heads and crash to Earth and kill everybody. And that's never the case.
Okay.
I mean,
well, it will
Bob's
be someday,
got all the
right?
details, but, you know, it's not going to be all that close or all that big.
Yeah, this one I agree totally. Valerie's right. This is 50% farther away than the moon at its closest approach.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a huge object the size of a bus, which is just not that large as things go. And so far as I see some of the headlines say, unbelievable speed, astonishing speed. Well, that astonishing speed is only half the speed that Earth lopes around the sun. And so you put it all together and it's a miss. It's a clean miss by a small object that's not going to not even be visible in the night sky. Forget about it. Worry about your cholesterol.
It's October 9th. It'll whiz past Earth on October 9th at 38,000 miles per hour. But don't worry about it. What if they're wrong about the track?
Well, even if they're wrong about the track, they're not going to be wrong enough so that this thing, instead of being 1.5 times farther than the moon,
okay.
Objects in space are like bullets trying to hit other bullets. The odds of a collision are very small. And once you find out their orbit and refine it, or if you're wrong, there's 1,000 ways you can be wrong that takes it farther from you. And there's only one possible direction change that makes it closer to you.
But so, things hit the Earth all the time, every day.
That's right. But nothing that really changes
our
lives.
Okay, we'll
right?
shoot that one down. This one from CNET. Apparently, the Andromeda Galaxy is a monstrous cannibal that binge-eats smaller galaxies. Valerie.
Gotta love that galactic cannibalism.
Yeah.
I teach this to my students every semester, and they absolutely love this word.
So what's going on?
So we've known this for a long time. The Milky Way galaxy is one of the few galaxies that's headed towards us. It's not moving away. It's moving towards us. But we've got some time. You know, we're talking about billions of years in the future when eventually the Milky Way and Andromeda are going to collide. Now, by collision, I don't mean, you know, all the stars and planets are going to crash into us. We're just going to kind of, you know, pass through one another, and we might be gravitationally tugged one way or another. But most scientific simulations show that the Earth is probably going to be okay. I mean, the galaxy will be a mess in the end, but the Earth will probably survive this.
Why is this galaxy, the Andromeda Galaxy, coming toward us when most are going away?
Well, that's because it's our closest neighbor galaxy. It's only 2.5 million light years away, which, yeah, that sounds like a huge number. But in reality, that's very close compared to the other galaxies. And the gravity between the two is just pulling them together. Okay. On small scales, that's what happens.
And far from being today's news, I know I made a headline. It's in my 1996 book, Secrets of the Night Sky. That's the book that got me on the David Letterman show.
Oh, really?
Nice.
And it was in the book about Andromeda's going to collide with us. That's in 4 billion years. That hasn't changed. And when Valerie says pass through, that's exactly right, because picture a galaxy made up of little dots, and each dot is 1 million dot widths from the next dot.
Yeah.
So the chance of any star in Andromeda colliding with any star in the Milky Way galaxy is actually very small.
How small?
No actual collisions will occur. Whereas the galaxies themselves, when you look at them from a distance, the galaxies are 20 galaxy widths away from each other on average.
Yeah.
Stars are 1 million star widths away from each other on average. So stars generally don't collide. It's only recently in the universe that we've actually had any examples of stars that merged at all. That's how hard they are to even find anywhere in the whole big universe.
Valerie Rapson is here. Bob Berman is here. It's Astronomy Today on the show. 800-348-2551 is the number. From MIT Technology Review, is Planet 9 actually a primordial black hole? Astronomers think there's another planet in our solar system, but no one has been able to see it. That could be because it's not a conventional planet at all.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this one. I think this is really cool. So to give everybody just a little bit of a background, this has to do with a story that came out a couple of years ago where astronomers noticed some objects in the Kuiper Belt out where Pluto is that all seem to make their closest approach to the sun at about the same area in space, which suggests that there's some other large gravitational body out there that is kind of pushing them all in the same direction towards the same location.
Yeah.
And for a long time, we just assumed that it would probably be another planet that we haven't seen yet, probably captured from maybe another star system or was just floating around. But this paper actually suggests that it could be a very small primordial black hole that the solar system has captured.
How small?
We're talking, you know, Earth size or maybe a couple Earth masses. So really small on the scale. And what's funny is if you actually read the scientific paper, they have a two-scale model of how big the black hole would physically be. Mm-hmm. And it's about half the size of a sheet of paper. Five Earth masses squished down to something that would fit on a sheet of paper.
Wow. Bob, what do you think about that?
Well, yeah, because when you talk about black holes, it's not really size, it's mass. And
right.
Valerie correctly, she ought to be correct with a PhD in this. Dr. Repson, yes, indeed, talked correctly about mass rather than size. Anyway, it's tricky to talk about the size of a black hole because if you're there inside the black hole, what you see is a thing getting smaller and smaller and smaller until, if you go by general relativity, you have zero size and infinite density. In other words,
which
zero
can't
volume.
Happen, right?
Well, not in the physical universe of what we would call reality. How can anything occupy zero space, and how can anything have infinite density?
Right.
So because that doesn't seem to exist in the real world, some are saying, well, something must stop the black hole from collapsing at a certain point. For example, maybe the strong force, one of the four fundamental forces of nature, steps in a way we do not yet understand and somehow stops it. Because if you just go by Einstein, there is no stopping it. It gets to zero volume and occupies no space at all. And this is why you'd have to say, what is its size? And then to confound that further, if you're not in the black hole, which we're not, if you're outside observing it, as the black hole tries to start to collapse, it never gets any further. It freezes. So from your perspective, it stays the same size, frozen,
mm-hmm.
and never gets small at all.
Right.
So maybe the better word for it would be a frozen star rather than a black hole. And it will become a black hole, but it'll take infinite time for it to happen, and infinite time hasn't yet passed and never will pass. So what we're saying is that it won't be a black hole for anybody who's outside the black hole, which is everyone in the universe, including us. So bottom line is, who's to say what size it is, and it depends upon where you are and who's asking.
Well, you know, my question is, this goes against my limited and probably incorrect understanding of how these black holes are. Now, I thought the black holes were essentially an engine for galaxies. They're at the center of galaxies. But this would indicate that they're bunches of them just floating around.
Right, right, right. There's many different types of black holes. You're thinking of those supermassive black holes that are humongous, you know, millions of times the mass of the sun at the middle of the galaxies. This is what we call a primordial black hole, if it truly exists. And these are thought to come about shortly after the Big Bang, where material is collapsing to form stars and galaxies, but so much of it collapses in one spot that it forms a very small black hole instead of a physical object. So these are on a much smaller scale.
Yeah, well, the regular black holes are, as Valerie said, supermassive, which means we think most galaxies, maybe all galaxies, have a supermassive black hole in their heart that everything goes around. Our Milky Way has one that with the mass of 4 million suns. The largest one we know in the galaxy M87 has a black hole of 9 billion suns worth of mass. Mm.
That's the one we took a picture of, right?
Yeah, this is great. And through telescopes of the kind that we like to show people coming off the west side of that, I almost said West Side Story. It is sort of the West Side Story of this this superluminal, at least we used to think it was superluminal, a jet of material that the black hole is sending out, and especially the one on the west side, is visible through good backyard amateur telescopes. Mm-hmm. So you can actually see the stuff coming out of the black hole in the center of this galaxy, M87 in Virgo.
Let's take a break. The lines are loading up here. We have many more headlines, but we'll hold off on those and take some calls. 800-348-2551 is the number. Valerie Rapson, Bob Berman, your calls coming up next. It's Vox Pop on WAMC Astronomy today. Valerie Rapson, Bob Berman are here. And before we get to the calls, a big fun, kind of a fun for amateurs and experts alike this weekend.
Yeah, we've got International Observe the Moon Night coming up on Saturday.
Oh, neat. What is it?
It's very exciting, actually. I mean, you'd think with the big telescopes that we handle, I have two observatories. Valerie runs the most famous one in the capital area, and you'd think with this kind of equipment, we'd be mostly focused on galaxies and on esoteric things. And why isn't the moon too mundane? I guess mundane is the wrong word. Isn't it too selene? What's the adjective for the moon? It's not mundane.
Cheesy. Anyway.
Big, beautiful, awesome to look at. Yeah,
buttery. I don't know where we're going with this.
But the truth is, the moon offers more detail than any celestial object.
It does.
It's forgiving of cheap optics, so that if you have a crummy telescope that's cheap, as long as the tripod isn't too weakly and wobbly so that it's really a bummer to use, you can see amazing things, but not on any moon. The full moon shows no craters or mountain ranges, even though people think, oh, the full moon must be the best. No, it's the worst. The first quarter moon is the best time, and within a day or two before to about 3 or 4 days after, so it's a block period. And if Saturday night is clear, that's the first quarter moon. That means the shadowing comes exactly perfectly to illuminate objects on the center. And I would say if you have an old telescope, maybe even binoculars if you can brace them steadily, but especially if you have an old telescope lying around, look at the moon that night, and just to find one object and be able to name it, look at the mountain range that's almost dead center on the moon. You can't miss it. It's right where the shadow line or terminator is passing, and that's the lunar Apennines.
Okay.
And if it's clear the next night or the next night, we're talking about Monday night, Tuesday night, the shadow line moves over, keeps moving at about the speed of a jogger, 10 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. And then after it passes the Apennines, the lunar mountains that you can't miss because they're in the middle of the range, ends like abruptly at this beautiful crater called Eratosthenes. And then as it moves further. Now we're talking about Monday night, Tuesday night in particular, and still nice on Wednesday night. So you got a lot of time to do this.
Yeah.
Then it illuminates arguably the finest crater in the entire moon, which is
Tycho.
Well, yes, Tycho in the south and Copernicus right
Copernicus.
In that line. So you follow the Apennines to Eratosthenes, and then there's Copernicus.
Okay.
It's got stepped walls heading down to the floor, like rice paddies that step down.
And like an old copper mine.
Oh, it's gorgeous with three mountains in the center, and it's almost 60 miles across, and it just takes your breath away.
Right.
So any telescope will show.
And even your eyes, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean,
take a look.
That's really what this Saturday is about. I mean, having a telescope is wonderful because you're going to get the detail that Bob's been talking about, but you really don't need one. Just go outside, take a look, and enjoy the moon.
All right, let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Mark in Salem. Mark, you're first.
Hi, Ray. I have two questions. One is more of a historical nature. Valerie may be able to answer that. Whatever happened to the Dudley Observatory's rare book collection? They had the first edition Kepler's and the first edition, and I remember handling them myself.
Wow.
Yep.
And
we do still have those. They are housed at Union College right now. They have a rare books facility, and you can make an appointment with them to go look at them anytime you'd like.
Oh, great.
But does the Dudley still maintain ownership of them, or is it,
yes.
is it turned over to Union College?
No, we still own those books.
Yeah, because I had the opportunity when Chris Bain was the librarian of helping her restore them.
Excellent.
It was kind of fun. All right, my main question is that I can't remember if it was Astronomy Magazine or Sky and Telescope. They're talking about optical interferometry that they're actually able to resolve the surface of stars. And it was in this month's issue of either one, I can't remember which, I don't have them in front of me, where they could actually tell that the star had dark spots on it similar to sunspots. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, sure. Betelgeuse was the first star that we saw detail using interferometry, but we've been
what
at
is
this.
Infra... Say it again.
Interferometry is the usage of far apart instruments so that you actually have a cancellation, a kind of diffraction effect, really, of the light waves that lets you produce an image synthetically and show detail that's far beyond what any telescope could otherwise see.
Wow. Okay.
Because of the spacing of the mirrors being so far apart, you'll have the same thing as if that mirror were that diameter. Could that technology be used to look at, say, the surface of Io or Europa?
No, because it doesn't show the detail that an optical telescope would. It's not the same.
It's
not the same at all. You would not be happy with the image.
Okay, because I was amazed that they were able to produce an image of the surface of a star or stars, actually, now at this point. That's never been done before, as far as I know.
Okay. Well, Mark, thanks
Thank
a lot
you.
For the call. We appreciate it. Our number is 800-348-2551. Taya in New York City, you're on.
Hi. I saw the movie Ad Astra last week, and it triggered a couple of questions for me. The first one is, it appeared to show, if I understood it correctly, that Neptune has like a disk, a ring of debris around it like Saturn. Is that true? Because I don't remember seeing that when I was
It's skimpy. All of the planets beyond Mars have rings, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. But they are so skimpy, except for Saturn's, that they can't be seen through any good telescope on Earth, not even Hubble. You have to go there. You need special techniques to show them because they're very, very, there's not a lot of material. So I wish we had two names for them, like there's Saturn, whose rings take your breath away. Even if you're looking at them for the thousandth time, they still do that. And I invite anybody, it's still out there in the Southwest at nightfall these nights. And the others are... they're almost mental things that they can be imaged through special techniques, but they're very skimpy.
But in this movie, he's near Neptune, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So if he was near there in this Ad Astra movie, which I've not seen. Anybody seen it?
Not yet.
I heard it's good.
Not yet. Do you think you could see it if you were there?
Maybe if you were there, you could pick out some individual objects. I don't know if you would actually see the ring in the sky or anything like that.
I don't know either.
Did you like the movie, Taya?
It was. It was very good. But that sounds like a little bit of poetic license. My second question was, they're using jetpacks in no atmosphere, and I think that that's the technology that, like, they use on the space station and stuff. How can you move around by pushing against something when there's nothing there?
Right,
like,
right.
How does a jetpack?
Yeah, that's an old argument that the New York Times got wrong. You know, it, very famously, I think it was in the 1920s, they criticized Robert Goddard because he was designing rockets in space, and the New York Times had an article saying, well, Dr. Goddard should go back to school because in space there is no air, and so a jet of gas is going out has nothing to push against, and so it wouldn't work. Well, it was they, the New York Times, who later issued an apology and a retraction that got it wrong, because we're just talking about Newton's equal and opposite forces thing. You don't need air to push against it to have that equal and opposite forces. So you push material, fast-moving jets out the back, and you're going to go in the other direction, and you don't need air to push against.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. We are doing astronomy on the program today. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman are here, and Colleen is in Ellenville. Colleen.
Hi, I'm calling because I have a question about when I'm standing in my backyard looking up at the night sky just with my bare eyes, and I will see in my peripheral vision what I think is the constellation of the Pleiades or Pleiades.
Could be.
But yet when I turn and I with my naked eye in the peripheral vision, I can see this like kind of triangle shaped cluster. And then when I turn my head to look at it straight on, two eyes.
Rods and cones.
Right. No, when you look at it straight on, what does it look like?
When I look at it straight on, it disappears.
Oh, well, what it usually does for most people is, because if you have 20/20 vision and you're in a dark place, and in the way where you are around Ellenville, it should be dark enough. You should see six stars of the Pleiades. If you can get to a really dark place, where I live, for example, in Willow outside of Woodstock, we always see eight, and I have seen 11 without too much difficulty. And but there are six that they're all the daughters of Atlas in mythology: Atlas, Pleione, Alcyone, Electra, Maia, and Taygeta. Then you'll see Merope and Asterope in darker skies. But they are there. What's happening is, with your peripheral vision, you got better vision when you're not looking directly at it, when you're looking a little to the side, because you're then using the rod-shaped cells in your eyes, which are giving you so-called scotopic vision, and that works best in low-light conditions. When you look directly at it, it's harder to see. But still, I'm puzzled when you say they disappear. If your eyes are not 20/20, they may turn into a glob, a blur, a blob, and you might not be able to discern separate stars, but they shouldn't disappear. I'd go back to my eye doctor.
Well, possibly, but could it be that her light condition, there's a lot of light pollution nearby?
The Pleiades is really bright, though. I mean, regardless, we can see it very well in downtown Schenectady, even with all of that light.
Well, so, Colleen, I'm with you. I've had that same thing happen when looking at the Pleiades in certain spots around here, so I know exactly what you're talking about. It's the rods and cones in your eyes.
Thank you.
And for everybody else who wonders what we're talking about, just look to the eastern sky these days, especially after 10 or 11 o'clock, and there's nothing else like it. It is a clear, beautiful, gorgeous star cluster, very tightly together. There's nothing else like it in the sky, and it's in the Bible, and it's Tennyson wrote about it. What was his line in Tennyson? Many a night I saw the Pleiades rising through the mellow shade, shimmering like a swarm of fireflies tangled in a silver braid. Isn't that lovely?
Wow.
I mean,
you're like Garrison Keillor. That's very impressive. Well, thanks, Colleen.
That's beautiful. Well, thank you.
Have a good one.
I appreciate it.
800-348-2551 is the number. It's Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman are here. Robert in Woodbury. Robert, you're on.
Hey, I was calling to ask if anybody has, or any scientist, has found a rogue planet yet. Like, actually been able to pinpoint it in space and say, hey, that's a rogue planet. Has that happened?
I'm trying to think. I recall a couple of news articles saying that maybe we had discovered one, but I'm not sure that we have definitively said, yes, we have discovered one to this point, because obviously they're very hard to find.
It's got to be really difficult, right?
Right, right. I mean, so they have no, they're not around a star by definition, right? They're a rogue planet, so they're not really reflecting any light. So you've got to look for the really cold thermal radiation from these planets, or maybe micro lensing around it or something like that. So they're incredibly difficult to find. I mean, like I said, I do recall hearing about them, but I'm not sure if there was any. I don't know, Bob, do you remember any discoveries yet?
No, also vaguely something like that, but you're right. If they're not going around a star so that they're either reflecting light or at least heating up by the star so that you're getting an infrared signature from them. If they're far from a star, how the heck are you going to see them? Because they're not
right.
Unless they are the kind of planet that's almost a dwarf sun, a brown dwarf. Mm-hmm. And so there's not quite a nuclear reaction, but there's enough internal heat to give off an IR signature and be detected by something like Spitzer that can detect infrared.
It has only been about 20, 30 years where they've actually confirmed planets around stars, though, right? It hasn't been that long.
Right. Yes, it's only been since the early 90s.
Yeah.
That's right.
All right, Robert.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thanks a lot. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson of the Dudley Observatory and Bob Berman of Astronomy Magazine and the Old Farmer's Almanac. And Fred in Wineskill. Fred, you're next.
So I always heard the Pleiades being called the Seven Sisters. That was a long time ago when I was a kid. Being a former youth, and I would run around the town of Brunswick in the dark nights of my teenage, I learned with my buddies and stuff, I learned to look at things not directly in those dark nights, and I could see a lot better.
Good.
So that's kind of interesting hearing about that. My question is, I was reading a book and it was talking about a term called Planck space, and they said in the book that it was actually the smallest unit of space. And I was wondering if that's really a possible thing, if that's true, and if you could also just kind of explain what it is and how they came up with it. And I'll listen on the radio.
All right. Thanks, Fred. Planck space. What is it?
Well, I'm not sure that I have heard of Planck space, but, you know, you can get down to really, really tiny scales. You know, we're talking on the quantum scales, and I forget exactly what the Planck length is, you know, 10 to the minus some large number. But it's basically the smallest measurable scale that we can get down to.
Yeah, the idea is that the smallest space that makes sense would be the quantum foam. This is all still theoretical. That underlying everything we see around us is a quantum foam, and the smallest part of that makes sense is of the Planck length, named, of course, for Max Planck.
All right. Our number is 800-348-2551, and Al in Saugerties is next. Al. Hello, Al.
Hello.
Hi, you're on.
My question is about the moon, and we've always heard when the moon is full, it affects the tides more. And I'm just thinking the moon is always full as far as mass and volume is concerned. So what's up with that?
Well, it has to do not just with the full moon per se, but its alignment with everything else in outer space. So whenever we experience either a full moon or a new moon, you've got the Earth, the moon, and the sun all in one straight line in outer space. So you're adding those tidal forces together. Not only do we have the tidal forces of the moon, but also the sun's tidal forces exaggerate what we see here on Earth. So they'll be a little bit stronger in that alignment. And then when we have first and third quarter moon, we'll have the weakest tides, because the tides from the sun are counteracting the tides from the moon.
Well said. And specifically how that works is that people think of the moon as pulling on the, especially the ocean, the water. But the truth is, I love this. If you were a drop of seawater, and there is the moon, only 181 the mass of the Earth, much less massive than Earth, and far away. And remember, gravity falls off with the inversely with the square of distance. So the moon's actual pull on each bit of water is tiny compared to the pull of the Earth right below it. In fact, the pull of the Earth is over a million times greater of a force downward than the pull of the moon. So seawater cannot be pulled upward, not even by the width of an atom, towards the moon, because it's no contest. Mm-hmm. The moon's pull upward is counterbalanced by the far stronger pull of Earth's gravity downward there on each bit of water. Mm-hmm. What really happens is when the moon is rising, and this is only when it's rising for any given place on the ocean, then the moon's pull is sideways, horizontal towards the moon, and that's not counterbalanced by anything. There is no pull in the opposite direction from where the moon is to stop that. So water is moved a little bit towards the rising moon, and this adds up and adds up and adds up until what you wind up with is a bulge that averages 3 feet under the moon. Mm-hmm. And when this 3 foot bulge reaches the seacoast, typically because of the shallowing effect, it rises to 5 foot, and that's the average tidal bulge. So that's how the tides really work. It's a horizontal torque, not a vertical torque.
And how much influence does the sun have? The sun has so much more mass, but it's so much further away.
3/8 right. of the moon's pull.
Yep, exactly. Because it's so far away. You're exactly right. It's much bigger, but it's a lot farther away.
All right, the number here is 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman are here. It's Astronomy on the program today, and we'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC Astronomy Today. Bob Berman is here. Valerie Rapson is here. I'm Ray Graff. Our number is 800-348-2551. And Doug in Newburgh is next. Doug.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. My wife and I are retired, and she asked me, is there anything on your bucket list? And believe it, one of the things that I'm looking to do is just to find a place where the sky is so dark that you can look up and feel as if you're standing at the edge of space and really look out and see the Milky Way and that.
Oh my gosh.
All the stars.
Yeah, Bob's raising his hands.
I have no idea where to go. Okay. I'm so with you on this, and I'm sure Valerie is too. I'm so with you on that, that better than any telescope, better than anything, is to be in a truly pure area of the planet Earth, of which there are fewer and fewer of those, especially when the Milky Way is high overhead. And if you're in a place like that, the Milky Way actually casts shadows. So I take a group down to such a place, which is the High Atacama Desert. We do this every single year. And I make everybody at one point stand with their back to the Milky Way so they can see their shadows. They wave their hands, cast by the light of the Milky Way, and you feel like you could just touch the stars.
Yeah.
It's the most fantastic thing. If you want more information, specialinteresttours.com. It'll list how to go. I know I'm allowed to mention this once on the program. This is my once.
All right. Well, very good. Now, what if you went to Antarctica? What would you see there? You wouldn't see the Milky Way, right?
No, the Milky Way would be pretty much coincident with the horizon from Antarctica.
What would we see that would be special if we were there?
Well, it would be dark, and it would be the problem is how much clear sky you would get. I had some colleagues who were who spent 6 months in Antarctica, and they said the skies were good. I do go to Alaska every year, and the rural parts of Alaska, of which there are many, mm-hmm. are also quite pure. But there's another factor that you want to, and that is how you don't want to be too far of a high latitude, because then you're missing half the sky. The Milky Way is too low, and the things in and around the Milky Way are so spectacular that I would say that if you're going to go and travel for that, go to a place that also is of a low enough latitude that you could get Orion overhead and Scorpius overhead. Those are the two finest constellations.
I thought the other thing you were going to say was warmth here.
Well, there's that. But I mean,
Alaska sounds lovely, but it also sounds pretty chilly.
I'm trying not to be a wuss here.
But there's nothing, if I were to go to the South Pole and look up, there's nothing out of the ordinary that I would not see.
Well, it would be out of the ordinary because you wouldn't be used to having the Southern Cross almost straight up. Mm-hmm. It just so happens that the area around the South Celestial Pole, unlike our our own familiar North Celestial Pole, which is Polaris, and there's the Little Dipper and the Big Dipper and the familiar circumpolar constellations. No, in the South Pole, the whole area around the South Celestial Pole is a big blank part of sky.
That's interesting. That's what I wanted to know.
The quickest way to find this South Celestial Pole really is to look around the sky and find the biggest dark area that has nothing in it.
Oh, wow. How about that? All right, back to the phones, 800-348-2551. Chris in Chatham. Chris, you're on.
Oh, hi. Actually, it sounds like the previous caller's question, I think, touches quite a bit on the question I had. But my question is a bit more general in when you're looking up at the sky in general, and maybe it doesn't matter where you're on the Earth, or maybe it does matter based on what you're saying about the South Pole, is what we see, the bright dots in the sky, what I would say are the stars. I'm wondering if mostly what we're seeing are actually stars, or are they more galaxies that we're seeing? Mm. You know, is it individual stars in general?
The stars. There's only one clear naked eye galaxy, only one, and that's a little smudge that's out at this time of year. That's the Andromeda galaxy. That if you're in dark skies, you'll see it as a little elliptical smudge in the constellation that bears its name. Everything else is a star, and not only that, everything else is a star in our own Milky Way galaxy. Now, if you get to really dark skies, there's one other galaxy. I used to think people were lying when they said they could see M33 in Triangulum. That's another galaxy, a little tiny bit further away than Andromeda, until I saw it myself from Oregon Pipe down in near the Mexican border. And then I finally saw it once from my own backyard in Willow outside of Woodstock. So I know you could see that, but that's tough. That's about as faint as you can get. No, they're all stars.
And they're all close by.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
In the galaxy.
Yeah.
You're relatively closest is about 4 light years. The farthest naked eye star is about 3,500 light years.
3,500. All right. Chris, thanks for the call. Number here is 800-348-2551. Tim in Freehold. Tim, you're on.
Yes. A few years ago, I was looking into the western sky. I think it was April. And I saw Sirius. And it was dazzling, sparkling, different colors. I thought it was a UFO.
No, I love that. I love that.
So I went and got my binoculars, and then I realized they were all doing that.
But Sirius does it in particular.
Seeing?
Yeah, Sirius does it in particular because it's got a spectrum. It's called spectral type A. It's an early A-type star. In fact, we love watching it spectroscopically because its spectrum is so pronounced. The red and the green and the blue parts are so clear. And, of course, Sirius is so bright, being the brightest star, that what happens, and I hear this all the time, is that if a star is very low on the horizon, it's shining through a lot more air, specifically 14 times more air than if it were overhead. And so when Sirius does that, we see momentarily one part of its spectrum, then another part, then another part. So we see it green and then red and then blue, and it rapidly changes. And this kind of, it's just gorgeous. It's the twinkling that all stars do. But with Sirius, it's unusually usually pronounced. And I've learned long ago, because being the director of an observatory, people somehow think observatories are UFO reporting stations. I'm sure Valerie gets that at Dudley Observatory. People think, oh, that's where I should call to report this UFO. And Sirius has proven to be the cause of a distinct minority of sightings.
Very much so, yeah. Sirius and Venus, for sure. Yeah, they fool everybody.
Now, regarding the twinkling, I was always told as a lad, tell me if I'm wrong or right, Valerie, that stars will twinkle.
Mm-hmm.
Planets will not.
For the most part, we see that that's true. And that has to do with what Bob was talking about, and also with the fact that the stars are so much further away than the planets. And by the time their light reaches the Earth, it starts to pass through the atmosphere, but it's very spread out. So
right.
It gets refracted in the atmosphere, and that enhances the twinkling. We call it scintillation. But the planets, since they are relatively closer than the stars, their light isn't as spread out. We don't get as much scintillation from them, so they often don't appear to twinkle.
Hmm.
And we're also generally getting a lot more concentrated light from those planets, so we don't notice the twinkling as much.
In your time of looking at the stars, Bob or Valerie, have you ever noticed an effect I've heard about, but I'm not sure I've ever seen, where there is an inversion, and there's almost a lensing effect, and the stars appear slightly bigger or you know, not moving, but sort of pulsing.
Well, unfortunately, this is the bane of astronomy ever since the time when Galileo first looked up late in 1609. And astronomers, backyard astronomers, those who use telescopes, always know that that's the bane. When stars are twinkling to the naked eye and you use any kind of magnification on them, they'll often look like just big blurs or blobs. When it's bad, you can't even tell that Saturn has rings.
Hmm.
And you can't even tell the grossest features on Jupiter, those belts, those dark belts, you couldn't even see that they're there. They turn into hopeless blobs.
Mm.
And we have a very technical name for that astronomers have used for centuries and still do, even at the biggest observatories. We call it seeing. Astronomers will say, how is the seeing tonight?
Ah, okay.
And then it's expressed, just as you were saying, Ray, in terms of size. Do stars show themselves as little points? That would be good seeing. Or are they blobs? And those are actually measured at major observatories. Huh. They have dedicated telescopes that measure the apparent size of these blobs that tell you how crummy the seeing is and how bad the observations are going to be that night.
Our number is 800-348-2551. Robin is in Albany. Hello, Robin.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I've been thinking a lot lately about red dwarf stars and eyeball planets, so I wanted to kind of ask an open-ended question. I was told by a scientist friend that these are sort of a disproportionate lot of what's out there. Then he said confusing things that confused me about tidal locking. So I wanted to ask an open-ended question about tidal locking. He said that moons and such don't like to orbit tidally locked bodies. If you can explain that to my poor little brain and any other interesting thing that strikes you to say about those sorts of systems, I'm all ears.
Right. Well, I'm trying to understand myself. I mean, so you've got your red dwarf stars. These are just smaller and cooler stars than our sun. And they, of course, can have planets. We're finding planets around them with the new test spacecraft and all of that. I suppose if you're talking about planets that are very, very close to the star, so much so that they're tidally locked, I think the trouble with moons is not so much that they don't want to or can't orbit the planet. It's that if you try and capture a moon or form a moon around a planet that close to the star, often the star's gravity will just capture the moon itself. So we don't tend to see moons around these planets, not because of the tidal locking, but because of their close proximity to the star. I think that's what he was getting at. I don't know. Bob, do you want to jump in there?
So far as the little red dwarfs, absolutely, they're the most common. We call them spectra class M. And of the 100 nearest stars, 57 are of this type. So the bulk are of this one spectral type. They're very, very, very common stars. With the locking, in our solar system, every single moon that goes around every single planet is locked in. So, you know, some people say, isn't it a coincidence that the moons orbit around Earth, which is 27.32166 days, is precisely the same as its period of rotation? No, that's not amazing. Every moon does that around every planet. So they're all locked together, if that's what you were talking about.
Well, and he went on to say that for a reason he didn't clarify, we don't see moons of moons. And he just said that orbits around tidally locked bodies tended to be unstable. Now, mind you, this is a geologist, not an astrophysicist, and he recently told me to stop bothering him and ask a physicist.
Just call us, right? Right. Yeah.
So that's why I'm here.
All right. Well, Robin, thanks a lot for the call. And now we go over to William in South Fallsburg. William.
Hello, Ray. I love your show, especially
thanks.
When Bob and Valerie are on.
Oh, terrific.
My question is, a caller earlier questioned about the pull of the sun and the moon on the tides. I'm wondering, could the sun and the moon have an effect on the water table?
Huh.
Now, the way it works, you have to understand is that neither the sun nor the moon has any affinity for water. What they're acting on is a large body. If they affected water, then it would go along with that pseudoscientific thing that so many people believe, that which is we're mostly made of water. So when the moon passes overhead, why aren't we affected by the moon? It doesn't work like that, because a tidal effect is different from a gravitational effect. What's happening is that, picture the Earth with its 8,000-mile diameter, compared to the moon's diameter, moon's distance of 250,000 miles, roughly. So what happens is that the moon's pull on the side nearer of Earth, nearer it, is a little stronger than the pull on the side of Earth farther away. Now, the difference in this pull is not what creates the tides. It is the tides. Mm-hmm. A tidal pull is a difference in your gravitational pull. I'll say that again. A tidal pull is the difference in the gravitational pull between one side of an object and the other. Now, because Earth has this big 8,000-mile diameter, there is a difference in distance to the moon, so there is a tidal pull. When you're standing out under the moon, and this will answer your other question, what's the difference between the moon's distance to your head and the moon's distance to your feet, another 5 or 6 feet further away? It's essentially zero, so there is no tidal effect, and therefore no motion of water that's towards the moon at all. So that's how it works, and that's why a water table or just water that's flowing underground will not be affected by the moon or the sun in any way.
All right, William, thank you very much. And quickly we go now to Joe in New Baltimore. Joe.
Yeah, hi, guys. Great show as usual. So this is a pretty simple question. It kind of relates to your Newton's equal and opposite thing. Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. As I understand, they deal with rockets and not with jets. Why is it still called Jet Propulsion Laboratory? Well, I think rockets have been around longer than jet engines. Right.
Okay, great question.
I don't honestly recall the history, but Bob looks like you might know here.
But when we're talking about jet propulsion, it's the same thing. The idea is that you're creating propulsion by a jet of gases going out one side, and then the equal and opposite effect, as you said, producing a motion in the other. So whether you call it a jet, if it's happening in the atmosphere, or a rocket, which is also first happening in the atmosphere, it's the same idea. So it's an appropriate name.
Okay, Joe, thanks a lot. Now we go to another Joe, this one in Hyde Park. You're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was curious. I'm an avid sailor, and there was a mention of going to a high desert. I didn't catch which one for some absolute darkness. I'm not quite sure what the term was used. But I'm wondering, when I'm 400 or 500 miles offshore in the Atlantic, or a couple hundred miles off the closest small island in the
Caribbean,
that'll
do it. That'll do it.
Am I in that same kind of darkness?
You are. One caveat. I'm sorry for jumping in. Just one caveat while I'm thinking of it, and that is the amount of moisture in the air. The advantage of the Atacama Desert, or any desert, if it's high, you have less atmosphere above your head, and if it's dry, you have less milkiness or diminution of the starlight. If you're on the ocean, you may or may not be in a dry place, so the stars may not be quite as good. That said, all of us who have ever been at sea, far at sea, mm-hmm. have been swept away by the grandeur of the sky. As I think you have also,
sure.
Right?
Well, thank you for that call, and we are done here. Support comes from Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs, edith-hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. SPAC Wine and Food Festival, featuring gourmet pairings, a farm-to-table dinner, music by Cafe Lena, John Van Alstyne sculptures, presented by the Hyde Collection, October 4th and 5th, SPAC.org. Quality Foreign Car Care, Boston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 30 years, QFCC.com. And the Albany Pine Bush Preserve, presenting Smoky Bear Day on October 14th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., featuring games and information on using prescribed fire to keep the pine bush healthy, albanypinebush.org. Once again, thanks to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson of the Dudley Observatory for being here today. Thank you for listening. Great calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our space cadet at the controls. Ed Rosen and Kayleen White answered the phones. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we welcome the folks taking part in this month's Halal Food and Family Fest in Albany. Right now, stand by for the Capital Connection.